Oh, that is too hard.
Yeah.
That is too hard. I mean, I think my death row meal is definitely a banquet of some sort.
Yeah, nice. Go all out.
Yeah.
Go all out.
Oh, yeah, the seafood, the steamed, the steamed egg dish, something like typhoon shelter, fried style, beautiful, vibrant vegetables, and a mountain of rice.
Yeah, you absolutely can't go past the rice or any just carbs in general. awesome, Jess. How do you feel now that the book is out in the world?
Oh, it's kind of crazy because I literally haven't stopped to feel what it's like. So there are moments where I'm like, oh, the book's not out yet. Oh, I'm still doing promo. And then the next minute I'm chatting to someone about the book like we are right now. And I'm like,
Yeah.
oh, it is out there. And then I go through levels of existential dread.
Yeah, I can only imagine, especially, we're talking about a topic that is the food industry, and it did face, for lack of a better word, an existential crisis during the pandemic too. I can only imagine what it must be like.
Oh, completely. I mean, Melbourne has changed entirely in the way that it does business. Not only, because of lack of staff. Like, we used to have every restaurant open like 5, 6 days a week, some open 7, and now it's kind of not a possibility. And then, one of my best mates is actually in Perth right now as a chef. But prior to that, he was working in New York, had 8 restaurants in Mexico, and had lived over there for over a decade. Came to visit, got stuck here with the pandemic, and now he's got 2 restaurants in Perth.
Wow, I was going to say the most isolated city in the world. Well done. Jess, I obviously love the book, and I particularly love the non-linear narrative that has been chosen, where there's each little chapter kind of jumps back and forth between poignant moments in your life and the food industry, which has been a massive part of that. I'm wondering, has the trajectory of the book and what you actually wanted to be on the page changed since you first started writing?
Oh, wow. I think, when I first started writing it, I really was reluctant to put a lot of information about myself in there. As with most people who come from a journalistic background, where you're like, it's about the story, it's not about me. And obviously, when you write a longer format thing, you're like, oh, I kind of have to add a bit of humanity in there. And especially when you're writing something like that, you have to write about yourself. Not only to relate to other people, but also so you don't incriminate your friends.
Yeah, we don't want to do that, do we?
No. Once you've worked in the industry for a while, you get a feel of what's litigious and what's not. And while some of my favorite stories didn't make it in there for legal reasons, I can always repurpose them somewhere else in fiction and, have a laugh about it in that format.
Yeah, and humor's such a great vehicle to do that. Trauma porn is something that's definitely, I don't know if it's, you could say it's in the zeitgeist, but it's definitely a thread through a lot of biographies and books that I have been reading recently. And I think you've struck this really cool balance between telling those stories that you needed to tell about yourself and what you've done and finding the droll kind of humor in that too.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of how we all end up in hospitality as well, and like after doing a service, because every service is hard. If someone tells you they've had an easy service, they were probably letting the team down. It's that thing of if you can't laugh about it, what are you going to do?
Yeah, totally agreed. Jumping straight into the, I guess, the meat of the story, no pun intended. There's going to be a lot of that, Jess, just warning you. Fair warning. You speak about your father and grandfather in the book, and you also describe some really awesome food memories surrounding them. And it reminded me so much of my great grandfather, who was a Sicilian fisherman. And I remember
Oh,
there were
amazing.
many lunches where we would have, like, he would launch live crayfish into the dining room and just let them scutter around and do the things like eat the whole fish heads and pig trotters and things I now love and are just a big part of my life and my love of food. What role did your family play in the formation of your food experiences, do you think?
Well, it's like I grew up in a really fractured family where, it was just really disconnected. We're all very emotionally damaged and unable to communicate with each other. And I think the only time where, we weren't at like angsty or like at odds with each other is when we're around the dinner table, especially with extended family. And so, you know, obviously those became my fondest memories because they were the only times I weren't living in terror. But then, you know, with a lot of ethnic families, you learn all your lessons through food. And, you know, you learn filial piety, you learn the hierarchy of things, you know, respect and the ability to appreciate the small things. And I think they're the things that have informed, you know, my taste and my senses and even, you know, the qualities that I appreciate as a food writer.
In the book, you do take a trip to New York and experience all these really wonderful things to do with food. And then you came back to Melbourne and you started to unpack your own role. As you mentioned, you've worked in the food industry quite extensively, and you kind of realise we all have a role in contributing to, I guess, the cultural appropriation of a lot of cuisine as well. Can you talk us through that shift for you?
Well, you know, it's that classic thing of when you're in it and when you're doing it and you're working so hard and you're literally just working and sleeping, you don't really see what's happening in front of you. And the cogs just keep turning and you're a part of this huge machine and you don't understand what the mechanism is. So when I went on holiday and when I removed myself, I was able to step back and see it in a different, you know, different environment, a different country, except, you know, everyone's always trying to emulate New York or London or Paris. And, you know, we're doing the exact same thing here. And I kind of worked out which part of the machine I was. And when I came back, it was just not the same. Everything felt not quite right. And I would like to hope that since then, my career trajectory has been about correcting those wrongs or at least shining a light on cultural appropriation and how things could be more diverse.
Yeah, it's a huge issue in Australian food, and you do touch on it quite a bit. And I feel like the book as well has this, it's really class conscious too, which is a conversation that Australians are just really shit at still. And you know, raising the idea of food as being apolitical, which I don't know if it necessarily can be, because, you know, like you were saying, food does often reflect a lot of the inequalities in society and show the same, you know, structural issues that we do face at large. It's something I've been wondering about a lot recently. Do you think food can be apolitical, and, you know, can we watch a show like MasterChef and just watch it because it is what it is?
I actually don't think it's possible. I think if you look at food and food shows and food culture completely apolitically, it's kind of like you have so much privilege you don't have to consider these things. And I think that taps into the class consciousness and, you know, shining a light on all the differences, because going back to, you know, conversations about family and, you know, fish heads and pig trotters, it's like we probably ate that because we came from peasants and we made these seemingly disgusting things delicious. So much so that, you know, they made it into other cuisines. They've been used for different purposes. You know, people go to restaurants and they're like, oh, I love pig trotter. And order it and you're paying a premium for it. So it's actually now pricing out the community that it used to serve.
It's so true, and you do talk about that in the book, and it's something that I've had to really, you know, take a look at myself and think, you know, why do we expect a lot of cuisines to be cheaper than what they're actually worth as well?
Yeah, because we need to ask ourselves, how are these cuisines cheaper? Because the food costs the same, the labour should technically cost the same, they're not getting charged less rent, less overheads, less taxes, and you know, if the food is that cheap, it just means someone down the line is not getting paid.
On that note of, I guess, fairness in the industry too, that's a huge issue. And I know a lot of listeners out there, and yourself and myself included, who have worked in hospitality, know that it's not necessarily the most equitable place to be. And one of my favourite chapters is when you kind of decode job ads in the food industry. Hardworking and energetic staff required translates to, that'll be, you know, you'll be required to drink 3 cans of energy drink on the market, and, you know, burnout, you know, and saying you're burnt out will mean that you'll be fired. Just so funny, but funny, not funny, haha, funny, like it's very true. Do you think the industry itself needs to change? Can it change? Or is it just a matter of it is what it is, people have to put up with it?
I think we're slowly getting there. I can't speak for all of Australia and all operators, but I noticed that over COVID, because obviously everyone had to close for long periods of time, even small business operators got to spend time with their families again. They knew what it was like to sleep 8 hours a night and wake up refreshed. And they're like, oh, I haven't had like work-life balance in like over a decade. I can't go back. And I also don't want my staff to not have this work-life balance. So they changed their operating hours, or they hired more people and gave them less hours. You know, they changed the prices of their food to be able to pay everyone properly. And, you know, I think that's a fantastic change. You know, there are some younger business owners who make it a priority for staff to have, you know, be able to see a gig on you know, a Friday night, because that's the only night an international act is playing. You know, they want to make sure that they can celebrate their birthdays, because, you know, back in my day in hospitality, I didn't see any gigs. I didn't go to any birthdays. I missed all my friends' weddings. I missed everything, really. And you know, it just wasn't a question with asking your manager or asking your boss. It's like, if you ask, you're stupid and you're going to get fired. You know, obviously it's a lot easier for small businesses to do it, not just because of expectations that the public place on them, but because they had, you know, it's that thing of, it wasn't until I was a business owner that I could draw the line with customers and say, that's not on, you can't do that, I'm the licensee, get out, can't talk to my staff like this. Whereas when I was an employee, you just have to take it.
What's it like being a business owner compared to being someone out front of house on the floor, like you describe in your book?
Oh, wow. Well, it kind of goes back to perception. I think one of the biggest differences is, well, when I worked at my own venue, the majority of my staff were male, and I was the youngest person in the business as well. And people would just automatically walk in and go straight for the male and be like, oh, I want to do an event. And they're like, oh, you have to talk to the boss. And they'd point at me, and I'm there, you know, either setting tables or restocking or like pre-batching booze, prepping stuff. And they're like, oh, and they just look over me and they're like, oh, who are you talking to? Who are you talking about? So, you know, that was quite wild. I'd like to say you get used to it, but you really don't.
Yeah, I don't think you can. That's, yeah, that's never fun.
Yeah, and then I think it's just being the boss, you do have that ability to demand that your staff are treated with respect. And the only time I've ever had an owner stick up for me during a shift was at that job that I talk about in chapter 2, when a couple buys the gastropub. I remember there was this drunk guy in the bar and he was just oying me for attention. And, you know, the owner just kind of got all maternal. Like, you don't oi my staff. One more oi and you get out of here.
I love that so much. And, you know, if only every boss was like that. It's definitely an issue, you know, to a certain extent. It's not just faced in the hospitality industry. I think a lot of industries do still have to put up with a lot of this gendered nonsense and this very blurred line between work and life balance too.
Oh, completely. And it's one of those things as well where it happens in every industry, I'm sure it happens in yours, where there are open secrets and people do not feel the consequences of their actions. So the toxic nature of what they do just continues, whether it be sexual harassment or racism and severe underpayment, bullying. And, you know, it's that thing of how is it going to be fixed?
Yeah, exactly. We don't have time to talk about that today, Jess, but maybe in the next interview we can talk about that. Finally, before I do let you go, I know you've got a busy day today, but what do you want the biggest takeaway to be from Raised by Wolves?
I think the biggest takeaway should be a little kindness goes a long way.
Well said. Can we leave it there? I truly love that, and I'm completely with you. I think a lot of it just comes down to respect, and it's a great way to end it, Jess. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you.